Namo Buddhaya, Jai Bhim. So thank you very much for the questions. They're some very good and searching ones. So the first question that I'm asked is that other than in meditation, when do you think we touch upon the bodhicitta and find ourselves released from the tyranny of self? In some ways, I think it's not so much in meditation that you experience that release from the tyranny. I think meditation helps to build the conditions for it, but you're most likely to experience it in a situation that demands more of you than you usually readily give. And that's what Bhante speaks about with himself in Nagpur in 1956. You remember his response to the grief of the new Buddhists in Nagpur. He just suddenly found himself responding. So I think you do a lot of work, and then a situation occurs where you just respond. And your responses are not really coming from you. I think there are many situations in which this can occur. And I think they're usually going to be to do with other people. I think probably other people are the main arena for our experience of self-transcendence, for obvious reasons, because other people are the cause most often of our clinging to self. It's our confrontation with other people that most commonly accentuates our self-obsession. So it's when you're faced with other people who need something from you, which is maybe not really what you want to give or isn't quite convenient to you, you just find yourself going beyond yourself. And I think, again, it's not just meditation that's most likely to bring this about, or rather create the conditions for it. Meditation is extremely important in the life of a serious Buddhist, of course. But I think unless that life is accompanied by engagement, an active and vital engagement with others, even meditation can become a form of self-indulgence. So I think that we need to make sure that we are in a vivid engagement with other people in community, in one way or another. Whether living with others, which is probably one of the most powerful things you can do, or working with others and engaging with others in a very active way. That is, engaging with others who share your aspiration. I think that draws out your self-transcendence, and you're more likely, Bhante says, as I said yesterday, to transcend yourself when you're working very intensively with others who share the same ideals as you for an altruistic purpose. So, yes, let's not underestimate meditation, but let's not overestimate meditation. It's very, very important that we do meditate, because it's where we're trying to apply the principles of the Dhamma most directly in our experience. But it's in engagement with others, and especially engagement with others for a higher purpose, that you're most likely to find that you've slipped out of yourself. And I think if you work with others to try to spread the Dhamma, and try to spread the Dhamma beyond your comfort zone, going into situations that are more difficult, that you're more likely to find that you've just forgotten yourself, and especially forgotten yourself in teamwork, in serving others in the context of team. So, and I'm saying this partly on theoretical grounds, partly on the basis of what Bhante said, but partly on the grounds of my own experience, especially working in India, where I work with Indian order members and work often very closely with them. I'm not myself often in situations of danger, but sometimes, and in India today, the situation is getting more dangerous for people who are espousing causes that are not the official ones, so to speak. well, you do have to sort of let go of yourself to some extent. And a little bit I find that in Hungary too. But everywhere, where you work for the sake of the Dhamma with others, you can't say, I did that. You have to say, well, we are working in this way. So as the order reaches out to more and more people across the world, will there be a parallel need to establish more monastic-contemplative communities dedicated to full-time meditation and Dhamma study? And would order members choosing to live in that way still be living out the Bodhisattva ideal? Well, yes and yes. Very emphatically, yes and yes. There is a need for more people to live a more intensive, even secluded, monastic-style, meditative, studious life. And there's no reason why that should not be a living out of the Bodhisattva ideal. In fact, if it's not a living out of the Bodhisattva ideal, it's not really a contemplative, meditative life, if you see what I mean. I reminded, Padmavajra mentioned this the other day to me, that contemplative orders in the Catholic Christian tradition, and I think it's the same in the Orthodox tradition, ideally see themselves as contemplating for the sake of all, if you see what I mean. So you see your own efforts in meditation, your own attempt to understand the Dhamma more deeply, as a contribution to the world, I think if you can really feel that, it will mean that your contemplative and studious life is very effective. I think it's very important that this is done in the context of a larger community, and I think that's what the order offers us. It offers us the opportunity to live out the Dhamma life in a number of different ways in a dynamic interaction with each other. So that, you know, I might choose, for instance, to go and be very active spreading the Dhamma, you know, for instance, in India. And somebody else might choose to engage in deep meditation or in study in a retreat centre. We don't have really places yet that are very much like this. We've got a meditation centre at Vajraloka, but it's a teaching centre. Actually, the original idea behind Vajraloka was that it was a place that people could go, and especially order members could go, to just meditate. There could be a core of people who were just meditating, and other people came for periods of a year or more to join them. And I think we still need that sort of focus. And in some ways, I hope Vajraloka finds its way back to that. My own private wish. And that if Vajraloka doesn't do it, that somewhere else we do that. It's a meditating community, which some people come and join for long periods, longer periods of months and years, and then go back. So I think I see the overall community of the order and movement as having different modalities within it, some which much more outward going, some in a way more inward going, but there's a flow between them, and people would spend periods of more intensive introspection, call it that, more intensive meditation, contemplation, and periods out much more actively engaged. I think every one of us needs that modulation within our own life. We're all, believe it or not, encouraged to spend 1 month on solitary retreat every year. That's what Bhante's original idea was, that we would all engage in 1 month of solitary retreat every year. I think we're lucky if most people get a week. And that partly for practical reasons, and partly just because we haven't really got it going. I strongly suggest that if you're considering ordination, that as part of that package, you bring in a good period of solitary retreat every year, because it grounds your practice. you really see what you are and what your practice of the Dhamma means. So I think we need to see the total community as having a sort of modulation between the more inward and outward going aspect, to put it like that. And we need to see each of our lives as like that. On a even daily basis, there's a modulation between the inward going and the outward going. On a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, on a yearly basis, over a lifetime, there need to be periods of inward solitary reflection and meditation, and periods of very active outward going engagement. I've certainly done this myself. And you know, I'm going from here to do a solitary retreat. 10 years ago, I did an eight month retreat, 5 months of it completely alone. I think we all need to do that. Go in and go out. The community as a whole needs to have some who are going in, some who are going out, and there's a sense of interchange, interplay between them. That the overall, the Bodhisattva as a whole holds many different implements, do you remember? And there are some hands that are, as it were, going in, performing the more inward-going meditative activities, and some that are going right out into the world. A healthy community has the whole spread, and a healthy human being has the whole spread. Of course, each of us will have predilections. Some of us are more disposed to go out into the world, and some of us are more disposed to go inward. And you can work with that tendency as long as you're not exclusively bound to it. As long as you're part of an overall community which has both modalities within it. I remember Bhante suggesting, for instance, with Right Livelihood businesses, it should have two teams. Half of one team was on retreat, and one team was engaged in the activity of the Right Livelihood business. We never attained this, but maybe we will in the future. But anyway, the overall point is that the Bodhisattva is both inward going and outward going, extrovert, introvert. Bhante brings this out very beautifully in his exploration of the six paramitas, the altruistic and individualistic dimensions, and so on. The overall life of the community should have all of that going on. And if you're outward going, and you're in relation to those who are inward going, again, to call it, that's not quite right way of speaking of it, well, your outward going activity will be supported by the inward going, and vice versa. This is a very, very important point. What is the relationship between spiritual rebirth and development of the bodhicitta? Are they the same thing? Yes. After all, what does spiritual rebirth as a practice in the system of meditation, how is it best expressed? It's best expressed in the contemplation of the Buddha or Bodhisattva. It's the sadhana practices that are the exemplification of spiritual rebirth, the stage of spiritual rebirth, just as six element practice is the exemplification of the stage of spiritual death. So really the development of bodhicitta, which of course consists partly in seeing through self-identity, spiritual death, and in connecting with what transcends spiritual death, which is spiritual rebirth. So it's really the same process, but looked at from a slightly different point of view. Has your response, your emphasis on the importance of surrendering to the bodhicitta, been a response to the current difficulties in the movement and society? Well, I certainly haven't myself emphasized this as a response to those difficulties, whether in the movement or society. Of course, I've to some extent framed my emphasis on them in relation to that to some extent. For instance, acknowledging that we, certainly in the West, have a strong emphasis on that is individualistic, and the tendency of our modern consumerist culture, post-Enlightenment culture, is individualistic. So, yes, I have emphasized that in trying to communicate this. But, for instance, that what I've been communicating to you over these last days is exactly what I've been communicating in India, where the individualism is not specifically the issue. There, the problem is more that people have an overly social understanding of the Dhamma. So I see the Bodhisattva ideal as transcending and, as it were, unifying both the individualistic and the social, not to say altruistic. In India, people are more concerned with the Dhamma as a way of responding to the oppressive social system of caste. And their concerns with the Dhamma are more focused on that. Too much, to a fault. Here, perhaps, we're more focused on, you know, our own pain and suffering, and too much, to a fault. Actually, we need both. And the Bodhisattva ideal is the resolution of both. So a lot of what I've been saying is exactly what I've been communicating in talks I've been giving in India. And it's been particularly gratifying to me that here I've been able to do that in talking about Dr. Ambedkar, because on the 14th of April, coincidentally or not, came up during this time, and because my dear friend Vivekananda Ratna was here to communicate just what it means to him. So it's been very gratifying to me, and I felt very strongly that this time, in a way that I've never felt quite to the same extent, I've been communicating exactly the same here as I do in India. I've said nothing different. Even some of the ways I've talked have been very much what I've been saying in the National Network of Buddhist Youth conferences, in the Sri Ratna Youth retreat that we held quite recently, with only 200 or so people. The National Network of Buddhist Youth, we have 800. On the Order retreat at Bodh Gaya, came in, was there, Ratna was there. Same things we've been talking about there. So, my emphasis is not simply to do with what I think is, in some quarters, a rather individualistic and rather theoretical or conceptually based emphasis on insight and attainment in our own movement, even at the moment, and the general trend towards, in Buddhism in the West, an emphasis on, yes, attainment, getting the technique right, and so on, which I find alien to me personally. It certainly is an answer to that, but it's not the reason why I'm emphasizing it. Everybody needs the Bodhisattva ideal. And they always will. They always have done. I'm sure that our movement needs it right now, as always. So, yes, I wouldn't like it to be seen that I'm simply trying to correct something. I'm emphasizing something that I think is always necessary. So then, some very interesting issues. Is there a suggestion running through your talks that Bhante is a Bodhisattva? Another one, Bhante regards Dada Rinpoche as a living Bodhisattva. The Indians regard Ambedkar as a Bodhisattva. I, whoever the question is, regard Bhante as a Bodhisattva. Is there anything wrong with stating this publicly at my center and so on? Or would you advise me to keep this opinion to myself? Well, I'd certainly advise a degree of circumspection about making sort of claims, whether on your own part or anybody else's, because it puts people in a difficult position. it puts them in the position of being forced to agree with you or not agree with you, if you see what I mean, whether it's about yourself or about anybody else. So I think that's unfortunate. That's something I find uncomfortable when I'm introduced. Padmavajra, of course, didn't do it this time. And anyway, the context is very different. But sometimes I feel, yeah, I'm pretty good. I'm not that good. And you put people in a very odd position. You either invite their scepticism, which I'm more inclined to personally, or their credulity. And I neither want to force people into scepticism, nor do I want them to be credulous, because credulity, well, the higher you put somebody on a pedestal, the longer the drop. Sometimes I'm really uncomfortable because I can already see the smash at the bottom when people realise, actually, I'm not that great. And just out of simple sense of self-preservation, I don't want to be put up so high. I've got a healthy sense of what it's like to fall, having fallen a few times in my life. So I think that be careful about asking people to believe something. You can express your confidence, but don't put that confidence in terms of any sort of claim. Actually, bodhisattva is a very elastic term. Bhante is clearly a bodhisattva insofar as he took the bodhisattva vow. In a sense, all order members are bodhisattvas insofar as they espouse the bodhisattva ideal. How far they've gone, which bhumi they are on, whether they've even got their fingernails, you know, on the first bhumi, or they're still scrambling around in the mud, I don't know. And don't bother about that. But what you do know is that within our order, people have taken on the bodhisattva ideal and are trying to be bodhisattvas. And so I think stay well clear of all claims, whether on your own behalf or anybody else's behalf. It just creates a very odd communication situation, because somebody's sort of asked to believe something about somebody else that how can they know? I remember somebody asking Bhante very early on, I think it was my second retreat, weekend retreat, you know, Bhante, are you a stream entrant? So Bhante said, it's a brilliant answer, probably got it out of a book somewhere, 100 clever answers for Madhamma classes. He said, well, if I say I am, how would you know whether to believe me or not? If I say I'm not, what difference does it make? So in other words, if you'll only listen to me, if I claim that I'm this, that, or the other, well, you know, actually, when you start to analyse it, how do you know? And if I say, oh, no, I'm just a thoroughly ordinary person, but, you know, what difference does it make to you about the Dhamma that I'm teaching you? It's not really that significant and not really that helpful. So, yes, I think you can communicate your confidence in Bhante, but you're not your confidence in Bhante as this or that. Again, I remember somebody asking Bhante, an order member, telling me that he'd asked Bhante in private, you know, Bhante, are you a stream entrant? Have you insight? Bhante's response was, it's important to have confidence in your teacher. Yeah? You get it? It just cut through it. You have to have confidence that your teacher is actually communicating you the Dhamma, and that the Dhamma he's communicating to you is the Dhamma. It's capable of taking you where you need to go. Be careful. Be careful. I do understand, and I was quite careful, actually. I think you'll find if you scrutinise the recording. I never made an actual claim, although I did sort of say what he says, which that is that he himself felt that at times he was operating, inspired by a suprapersonal force, which, I dare to say seems to me to be something like bodhicitta. So if I did stray too far in that direction, perhaps because I think that you, in having asked for ordination, are wise enough to put it in perspective. Yes, I think that we need to be very careful about interpreting our own experience in terms of these stratified Dhamma categories. I remember Bhante again saying that somebody had said to him, oh, I think that was such and such a bhumi that I experienced, or such and such a level of transcendental insight. And Bhante said, well, actually, that person, I did take seriously their experience, but what the best thing for them to do is to simply express the raw experience. Do you see what I mean? Rather than trying to fit it into this pigeonhole or that pigeonhole. Because in doing that, you sort of move away from the experience into a conceptualized category. And if you then start requiring of other people to accept that conceptualized categorization of yourself, well, you put them in a very odd position. A position which, if they accept it, they're taking a step outside their own experience, probably feeling a bit in awe of you, which is not very helpful, or you're inviting them to be, oh, yeah, come on, tell that to them. Anyway, whatever. I strongly advise you to be cautious about asking people you to believe anything about somebody else's attainment. At the same time, you have to communicate your own confidence in your teacher. And you have to have that confidence in your teacher. And no doubt, at times, that confidence will be shaken. We've had a big shaking of confidence. But then what one ends up thinking, and I thought this about myself, because I had some loss of confidence in Bhante in the early 2000s, that what actually was revealed was the inappropriateness of my previous confidence, if you see what I mean. I'd been confident in Bhante in a way that I shouldn't have been confident in him, in a way that he never asked me to be confident in him. And Bhante is the most scrupulous of people in this regard. He's never, ever, in my hearing, made any claim. He does talk about his own spiritual experience, but never in that sort of, in that stratified or hierarchicalized way. So I hope that's a useful, and it's a very important point, I think. That somehow the Buddhist tradition necessarily speaks in terms of levels, and necessarily you start to wonder about yourself and about other people. Resist the temptation, if you see what I mean. Follow the path and recognize the path does unfold in varying levels, but resist the temptation to categorize either yourself or others, and recognize that this is what you experience. What's going to happen next, you don't know. Peter lives with Vajradhaka, and I remember Vajradhaka telling me that when he first became a Buddhist, it was as a result of reading Alan Watts' The Way of Zen, which my generation all gained enlightenment through. He read the book and realized he understood every word of it, and realized he must have had Satori. He must have awakened. So he thought, he was traveling in Indonesia at the time, he thought, well, I've attained Satori, I'll just go into the jungle and enjoy my Satori. So off he went into the jungle, and after a few days, he realized that he was bored. And so, recognizing he was bored, he thought, I can't have attained Satori. You can see it, can't you? You tell him about this, remind him about this. I think that an honest person we'll begin to recognise, well, actually, it was a good experience, an important experience, some kind of insight how big the typography was of the initial I, you'll find out as time goes by, probably after 20 or 30 years. Just say, yeah, that was a really extraordinary insight of some kind, whether... I was thinking of the Spanish, majuscule or minuscule, the typography. But it was something, it was important to me. What it is for others, I don't know. So there you are. There's quite an important issue, which I thought about a lot recently, because we've had a bit of an outbreak of claim. It's like a sort of fashion. Yeah, very interesting questions. I'll come back maybe if I don't get time. We look at discriminating between I and not I and the pitfalls of it. We looked at this. Is there a danger of doing this collectively and discriminating between Sangha and not Sangha or Sangha and world? And if so, what safeguards are there against this? Well, yes, very astute question. I think that just as there is Atmavada in relation to I, there can be sort of an Atmavada in other terms too. I think this is a very common issue in all kinds of spiritual groups, and I think we at times have collectively fallen prey to it, or a number of us have. I think particular institutions fall prey to it. And what you get is a discourse of superiority, inferiority, or we're really doing it, they're really not, of often sometimes even contempt. I've known this in our order, I've done it, where you talk about us having got it right, they've got it wrong, and that sort of thing. I think one has to have a degree of understanding of the way in which the mind does create inferiority, superiority, which is after all only an inflation or an externalization of I. It's just the same phenomenon. Yes, quite a bit of humility is required, and a recognition that, as I said yesterday, the order is sometimes a Sangha and sometimes it's not. Do you see what I mean? So don't identify order and effective Sangha absolutely. An order is perhaps more likely to become an effective Sangha than a not order. If it isn't, then it's worthless. But it doesn't mean it's always there. When I disrupted those two order members, one of them with a carving knife poking at the other, I don't think you could say they were an effective Sangha. They were scarcely even a group. Yes, a little bit of humility and recognition of the reality of the thing. And it's a great danger with spiritual movements, isn't it, that they become religious groups become contemptuous, superior, dismissive, and you just listen to the language. Is the language all about how good we are and how bad everybody else is? If you hear that language, you know something's wrong. The Dhamma, we do not have a monopoly of the Dhamma. The Dhamma, in a way, is not Buddhist. The truth is not Buddhist. I personally believe, from my own experience and understanding, that the Dhamma is, that Buddhism is the best way of realizing the nature of things, the truth of things. But I don't think Buddhists have a monopoly of it. You read and see and hear people speaking of their experience, and you think, well, they have got a definite glimpse of the truth. The reality, often because they don't have an adequate set of ideas to contain it, it's sort of distorted. And for instance, if the only language they've got is the language of God, the language of God can express very deep truths, But there's something about that language which sort of works against itself. And the great thing about the Dhamma is its critique of thinking. And I think this is something we need to be much more vividly aware of, that Buddhism has within it, Dhamma has within it, a transcendental critique, if you see what I mean. It's got a critique within it of all thought, of all ideas. It's got a critique of views. And the danger is that we take hold of right view in such a way that it's wrong view. I think we need to understand this, because you don't want to go to the other extreme and say, oh, it's just another view. We need to have some critique of thinking, even in a sense of what the Dhamma is. I personally believe some sort of Dhammic epistemology should be part of our training. Hint, hint. There should be some sort of way of understanding what it is when we think. What we're doing when we speak, and of what the relationship is between the words that express the Dhamma and the meaning that they attempt to express. So yes, the antidote to this sort of reification of the idea of Sangha and identifying Sangha exclusively with our particular group is some understanding of the nature of what we're doing when we think, what we're doing when we use words, but also a healthy internal critique and a relationship to the world around us. I think we're not so bad at this in our order at the moment. Sometimes in India, I think you get this because it's accompanied by, of course, some understandable superiority to the oppressive discourse of Hinduism. So, you know, we think because we're Buddhists, we're clear. Actually, we're not. We're often just as groupist as caste is, even sometimes reverse casteism, if you see what I mean. But I think our movement as a whole is not so bad these days. We're much more able to take people as individuals. That's what it really comes down to, isn't it? It's seeing people as individuals and facing them as they are, entering into dialogue with them, not coming from above to below, the en bas. Recognizing that they are, every individual who steps before you, you don't know what they are, where they stand. So yes, in the end, I think it's communication that saves us from this literalization of Sangha as the our Sangha as the ideal. A lot more to be said about this, but I've just sort of hinted at a few points. I think we used to be pretty bad, actually. Inevitably, we're all young, and with great enthusiasm, just getting going, and you know, one has to be a bit tolerant of that. People, when they've first discovered something, nothing so awful as the convert, the fresh convert, they're so in your face. But I've been one of them, and I think we should have a sort of an affectionate and tolerance of them, and so forth. They'll work it all out. To begin with, they're so enthusiastic, but after time, they'll realise it's not quite so simple. And I think, this development of the schema that was there saves us from that, where there's a sort of inward and outward going momentum, where we're constantly working out into the world and working back into it. So I think we are a lot better than we used to be, but we have to be on our guard. I hope we are. Yes, a little bit more asked about reaction practice, sort of how to do it, the stages of it. In some ways, I'm a bit reluctant to get over-specific about it, because I don't want to make it into another practice in a rather formalised way. because when practices become rather formalized, you can go through the motions of them without really doing them. But I think the first and most important thing is to really not want to react, if you see what I mean. To really have some sense of even almost disgust and shame about yourself for reacting. A tolerant and affectionate sort of disgust and shame. But a sort of thing, I don't want to do that. I see what this does to others. I see this what this does to me. So not just, oh, I shouldn't be reacting, but sort of thinking, well, this reaction spoils me. It spoils what I'm about. So it should come out of a definite, immediate, felt sense of the need to overcome this. And then a very strong recognition of when one is reacting. Not always easy to do, because a lot of the time we're justifying our reactions, justifying them by, you know, what the other person did, and so on. So I think there needs to be some understanding of what reaction is, an understanding of greed, hatred, and delusion as the bases of reaction. And yes, greed is a reaction. It's harder to spot because it's nicer. But actually behind greed is insufficiency, a feeling of emptiness. And that's why being dumped in a relationship is so good. I recommend it as a spiritual practice. I'm sorry, I know it's so painful, but fall in love and then have him or her dump you, as we say, or not respond, because you're faced with the pain of craving. The pain of anger is more obvious because your anger arises out of the sense of being transgressed. Where the pain of greed is, especially in a consumer society, is satisfied. The new iPad really does come out when you just begin to feel the inadequacy of the previous model. That's what a consumer society is about. It's about staying ahead of our sense of disappointment with our craving. There's a well-known psychological sort of pattern, isn't there, that your craving is rewarded and you feel really happy and satisfied, but then there's diminishing returns. So consumer society, they've actually studied this. It's conscious. The marketing and aspect of the society knows this, and they study when it runs out, and they produce the new model at the right moment, so that you have a renewed feeling of, ah, you know, when Amazon knocks at your door, and there it is. Look at it, the feeling of delight and satisfaction that at last, nirvana. And it really is a bit like that. You can be sort of quite intoxicated for a while and, you know, looking out for the postman, or the whole thing. But when it's thwarted, then you notice it. But with anger and hatred, you feel much more sharply the unsatisfactory aspect of it. All craving is actually about pain. But you don't notice it because you have the idea in your mind of satisfaction and the actual satisfaction. But hatred is much more immediate and obviously painful. So you need to learn to recognize that. And I strongly emphasized becoming more aware of the physiological dimensions of both craving and hatred. Interestingly, there's a very, very important sutta in Majjhima Nikaya called the Kayagata Sati Sutta, which means the sutta that's to do with, well, they say close placement of mindfulness, mindfulness closely connected with the body. And the Buddha lays out the benefits of mindfulness of the body. And basically he says, if you're mindful of the body, all good qualities unfold. Because it's by not being mindful of the body that you don't notice your craving or your hatred. Because you don't notice their immediate physiological effects. and you start to propunchize them, to build an intellectual or rather conceptual explanation and model of them, to have a set of images that go with it, so you don't notice the immediate physiological experience of pain. This is why mindfulness of the body is so important. It brings you back to what's immediately going on. So that's one of the main things about reaction practice, is to be mindful of the body, to learn to notice what's going on in you, so that you immediately sense the reaction going on, and then stay with the reaction. You know, because your mind is spinning stories. That's what propancha is. It's spinning stories that explain your pain and provide solutions to your pain. And most of them are pretty simple. Your explanation is, need chocolate, go get it, which is not a very sophisticated form of craving, but it can become much more sophisticated than that. Or, you know, I know what's going on. Those bastards, they've been plotting this, and this is what I need to do. Anybody done any meditation? You know these things go on in the mind. So you need to learn to slow the process down and notice what's going on, and don't let it manifest. First of all, don't let it manifest in body, and that is an action. Then don't let it manifest in speech, and then try to hold it, as it were, within the mind, and try to detach it from the stories that you're telling yourself, the constructions that you're putting upon it, and try to remain as closely as you can with the immediate experience of it. And it's difficult to express what I mean by this. You do think, but make sure your thinking doesn't become merely thinking. It's more like vitarka vichara in first dhyana. It's thinking that's related to the immediate experience, thinking that points you back to the immediate experience, rather than a constructed, tower, edifice of explanation. It's directing you back. You know, what does this feel like? Why this feeling of anger? Right, actually, I feel quite threatened. That's what it feels like. I feel a little bit of fear underneath that.